Ave Maria in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. Welcome to Ave Maria in the Afternoon, examining the world through the lens of faith from the heart of the Church to help us navigate the culture. Here's Dr. Marcus Peter.
Good afternoon and welcome to today's episode of Ave Maria in the Afternoon. I'm Marcus Peter. Perhaps one of the most significant pieces of news right now is that the Vatican's Doctrinal Office, the DDF, issued a highly anticipated report on the alleged apparitions of the Blessed Virgin Mary in Medjugorje. Now, we will continue to refer to them as the alleged apparitions because the report did not clarify whether or not these apparitions were of supernatural occurrence. What they will say, however, is that the report endorses a prudent devotion to Mary and Christ, and to the effect that the fruits of practicing that devotion and apparition fosters deeper faith in Christ and His Church. There's a nihil obstat there. But they've withheld any declaration on whether the alleged visions are supernatural in origin. And that's a crucial distinction. Dr. Matthew Bunsen joins us with this and more and on Other Church News. He joins us every Thursday to talk about news and church teachings in light of current events. And then we talk with Paul Kengor. A new book was published. Paul is the author, called The Stigmatists, Their Gifts, Their Revelations, and Their Warnings. And it's a well-written book. It systematically presents the lives of the stigmatists, those who have received the stigmata in their lifetime in the history of the Church. It also presents some of the private revelations that many of them received. And then in the last chapter of the book, he talks about modern-day stigmatists, some who are alive today as well. And he talks about the place of this particular miracle and why this manifestation of the miracle in the life of the Church right now. In particular, we need to address that this is a strange phenomena. Outside of the Catholic sphere, this would be considered bizarre, and yet the visionaries and the saints and the mystics who have experienced the stigmata become living crucifixions. They become living crucifixes. Living images of the finished work of Christ on Calvary on Good Friday. They portray to the world Christ's atoning death. And that's what we want to talk about, how they live out this heritage and what we can learn from them. So no, not all of us will be stigmatists, but all of us can be living embracers of the crucifixion of Christ. Stay tuned after the headlines.
Thanks, Marcus. Good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Thursday, September 19th. It's the Feast of St. Januarius. Today's news brought to you by the Ave Maria Family of Funds at AveMariaFunds.com. The Vatican has issued a highly anticipated report on the alleged Marian apparitions in Medjugorje. The Doctrinal Office endorsed prudent devotion to Mary at the popular pilgrimage site, yet refused to acknowledge or deny whether the alleged visions are supernatural in origin. Matthew Bunsen has the details this hour. Israel is attacking sites in Lebanon. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken speaking in Paris following those strikes.
There is a real problem that needs to be resolved when it comes to northern Israel and southern Lebanon, and that is the fact that since October 8th, Hezbollah has been firing rockets into Israel. Israel's been firing back.
The strikes come 2 days after pagers and walkie-talkies belonging to Hezbollah exploded and killed at least a dozen people, including multiple children. The U.S. said Israel was responsible for the booby traps, but they have not claimed responsibility. Israel's defense minister said that a, quote, new era in Israel's war effort was beginning on its northern front with the Lebanese militia. An Alaska man is being charged with threatening to kill six Supreme Court justices. The Justice Department says the 76-year-old was arrested after sending over 465 messages to the Supreme Court through an online portal. The messages allegedly contained extremely violent rhetoric. A group of nuns and other religious groups with charitable missions are asking the U.S. Supreme Court to block a New York State mandate that would force them to cover abortions in their employee health insurance plans. The mandate provides exemptions for religious groups that primarily teach religion, but the exemptions don't apply to ministries such as the Carmelite Sisters for the Aged and the Infirm, which runs a nursing home and serves those in need regardless of their religious affiliation. From your AveMariaRadio.net news desk, I'm Steve Clark.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. As is the case every Thursday, our friend Dr. Matthew Bunsen joins us, fresh home from his trip to Ecuador, the National Eucharistic Congress there. Dr. Matthew Bunsen is Vice President and Editorial Director of EWTN News. He's also a Senior Fellow at St. Paul Center for Biblical Theology. Matthew, great to speak with you again. How are you?
I'm sorry that I missed you last week, but let's just say connections in Ecuador sometimes are a little spotty.
We figured as much. We also figured you were having too much fun at the National Eucharistic Congress.
It was a remarkable experience to have, this is the 53rd International Eucharistic Congress, and to have 52 countries represented there. But I think some of the presentations especially were remarkable. I think of Bishop Munilla, for example, of Spain. Bishop Andrew Cousins from the United States, who's one of the architects of the National Eucharistic Congress, was there. He gave a very well-received presentation. And all of that culminated with two things, the procession, a Eucharistic procession through the streets of Quito with 80,000 people in attendance taking part, which was something that was very, very memorable and gorgeous given the city center of Quito. And then the other, of course, the announcement of the next International Eucharistic Congress in 4 years, which will be in Sydney, Australia.
Wow. Wow, Sydney, Australia. That's outstanding. And everything I hear about the International Eucharistic Congresses is nothing short of moving on a personal level, but there's a real sense of a Eucharistic revival that's taking the world by force. Just tell us about the sheer amount of people who were there and some of the testimonies of what was happening.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And what was particularly striking to your point, Marcus, is that the National Eucharistic Congress made quite the splash internationally. And there was a much discussion about it at the International Eucharistic Congress. As I mentioned, Bishop Cousins was there. But when I spoke with the Australian delegates, for example, they were very mindful of what had just happened not that many weeks ago in Indianapolis here in the United States. And they're seeing that as a real role model in many ways for going forward with like their own International Eucharistic Congress. Mm-hmm. International Eucharistic Congresses tend to follow a pretty set pattern of opening and closing masses, of course. You have this procession, the Eucharistic procession on Saturday, and then in the days intervening, you would have presentations and testimonies. And they were global by nature, but they did have, as any Eucharistic Congress will, some of the flavor of where they're being held. So, for example, in 2021, when I was in Budapest, there was very much a Central European sense, an Eastern European sense to it, a feel of it. This time, it was, I would say, very Latin American, very South American. And many of the concerns then of the people of those regions tend to be examined. So the one thing that cut across both of those Eucharistic Congresses, and I think that we have seen this before and we are likely to see this again in Sydney, is the mounting concern of secularism and relativism and the impact it's having on the faith of the simple Catholics, but on those who are searching spiritually and who are finding themselves really in a very toxic environment.
In the face of all of this, that wonderful theme, fraternity to heal the world, and grounding it in the love of Christ in the Eucharist as the only source of true fraternity, I think that's very fitting.
Yeah, it really was. And the timing of this was providential for Ecuador itself. They've had recent political upheaval, political violence. So this healing that can take place. But the first whole day was dedicated to an enumeration of the problems in the world. And Juan Manuel Cotello, who is a Spanish director, who is one of the speakers, said it quite well. He said in Spanish that, what's the state of the world? Well, it's terrible. It's terrible. And then the rest of the week, the next 4 days essentially, were spent, well, here's the diagnosis and here's the treatment. And the treatment was recognizing, as Bishop Cousins put it so eloquently, that the Eucharist is the heart of the world.
Yeah.
And that the more that we can make the Eucharist central in our lives, the more that we are equipped to carry that out into the world. And that we are impelled by the Eucharist to go out. But it also requires a proper transformation in our own lives. It means that we have to avail ourselves of the sacrament of penance, of reconciliation, to make ourselves worthy to receive the sacrament itself, but then to go forward in our own families, first with ourselves and our families, in our workplaces and our communities, so that we can truly be a Eucharistic people.
Yeah, I'm reminded of John Paul II's words when he spoke at a closing mass at one of these International Eucharistic Congresses, and I have them in front of me, from the Eucharistic altar, the pulsating heart of the Church. I mean, it doesn't get more, not only more profound, but also more accurate than that. The Eucharist becomes a pulsating heart of not just the Church, but from there to flow out into the evangelization of the world.
That's right, and that's the message of this particular Eucharistic Congress, of all of them. But it is that concern that they have for the world facing so many dire problems right now of war. Now, you can argue that this is a perennial problem, that the Eucharistic Congress is from 100 years ago, 40 years ago, would have been having many of the similar conversations. But the level of secularism, of relativism, mm-hmm. is something that I think has really risen to the top of concerns, because it brings with it this destruction of a sense of belief, a sense of faith. And one of the words that was used quite often was hope, that it destroys hope.
Yeah.
And the Eucharist gives us that hope, but it really does have to come down to understanding the Eucharist, deepening our love for it, deepening our adoration, and truly then carrying that forward. So it isn't something that we simply hide. We have to live it, but if you're going to live it, that means you have to proclaim it.
I want to expand the conversation, not just from the Eucharistic Congress you just attended, Matthew, but into the fact that we are 60 years past the Second Vatican Council.
Yeah.
You've got Lumen Gentium that calls every member of the Christian faithful in the Church to the perfection of charity. And a big part of that is this onus and urgency of the work of evangelization, this language of the new evangelization that gets heavily popularized by John Paul II. Mm-hmm. We've yet to barely scratch the surface on that reality.
Well, that's right. The universal call to holiness, it is engaging and forming the laity to have that key role in evangelization. And there's sometimes a misunderstanding. I think Pope Francis has used what has been criticized at times, I know, this term of that he called proselytism, quote, such solemn nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the things that he was getting at is that we can be overly programmatic.
Yes.
We can be robotic.
Right.
That we lack the zeal and the love that attracts people. As we discussed several times last week in our coverage, that Pope Benedict, who's picking up on so many of the themes of someone like Gisani, mm-hmm. talks about that we need to invite people to have an encounter, but it isn't simply an encounter with a list of bullet points of here's what you need to know. It's really having an encounter with a person, and that is the person of Jesus Christ.
And that distinction, therefore, that you made is crucial. We're evangelizing. Proselytization today in the context that we understand it has to do with religious recruitment, so to speak, right? We become programmatic. We've got these specific programs. But the language of the Church here really has to do with we are offering them the gift of the gospel. The conversion of the will is the work of the Holy Spirit and free will.
That's right. And we have to facilitate that. We have to be participants in that. And I think that's one of the takeaways from an International Eucharistic Congress like this, is that we have to help people first to have that relationship, but then also in their own lives and in broader culture to recapture a sense of joy, of love, and of wonder at creation. Because there is today this tendency of social fragmentation, of disintegration, and so many of these problems that are attendant with that, of loneliness. Here you are deeply connected with the Eucharist.
Yep. Well, Matthew, we are continuing this conversation with you on the other side of the break. My guest, Dr. Matthew Bunsen, Vice President, Editorial Director of EWTN News, and he's a friend. And we speak about church news and current events in light of church teaching. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
St. Therese once told her sister Celine that when we trust ourselves and not God, our soul becomes barren and incapable of virtue. Her remedy? External works of charity. We all try to do it on our own sometimes without asking for God's help. At St. Paul Evangelization, we suggest sharing the gospel with someone who needs it. Check out streetevangelization.com to find a team near you where you can share the love of Jesus. If there isn't one in your area yet, perhaps God is calling you to start a team in your city. To learn more, visit streetevangelization.com.
Ave Maria in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization: Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you with one of 1,400 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 70% to Ave Maria Radio and Human Life International. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
This program brought to you in part by the town of Ave Maria, Florida.
Ave Maria, a big kind of small town. A golf cart-friendly, ride-your-bike-everywhere kind of town with something for everyone. Resort-style amenities, two golf courses, shopping, and dining in our town center. With Ave Maria University and Ave Maria Catholic Church at the core of the community and a wide range of homes to meet your family's needs. Visitors are welcome. More information can be found at avemaria.com. Ave Maria, a big kind of small town.
We are the pro-life generation, passionate about building the culture of life in our healthcare and in our nation. But not all healthcare options are equally pro-life, and some provide morally objectionable procedures. CMF Curo is different. CMF Curo is a pro-life Catholic healthcare ministry providing a pathway for its members to build the culture of life in their healthcare choices, not destroy it. Learn more about CMF Curo at MyCatholicHealthcare.com. That's MyCatholicHealthcare.com.
Good afternoon. Welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. My guest, Dr. Matthew Bunsen, Vice President and Editorial Director of EWTN News, and we're talking about church news. So, Matthew, I like joking about the fact that there's never been a week where you and I have gotten together to talk and nothing has happened.
That's right. Well, and today is no exception. This week is no exception.
Yeah. No, not at all. And we kept this particular bit of news for this segment because we want to devote time to it. Medjugorje, the DDF pronounced on it after, and I had a feeling this was coming given the norms that were published before.
That's right.
Which greatly expedited the pronunciation on apparitions. And maybe one thing we can start with is to be clear, the Vatican is not positively granting approval or validation that this is a supernatural apparition. So let's just talk about it there.
Well, and that's a very important place to start, in part because the new norms that were issued back in May that you've just alluded to were very clear that there is going to be great reluctance on the part of the Holy See going mm-hmm. forward to do that, to weigh in on the supernatural nature of these. But it also, immediately the question was asked when these norms were issued, how long is it going to take until some sort of a pronouncement is made on Medjugorje? Because that is, in many ways, the most controversial, the most, I think you use the word convoluted, of all of the recent Marian apparitions, especially given its very long history now of 40-plus years. Now, we always have to stipulate, too, that every Marian apparition, every major one, has involved in some fashion or another, especially in the modern era going back into the 19th century, not necessarily some controversy, but many questions
yep.
that had to be asked. So this isn't necessarily unique in the history of Marian apparitions, but I think it's safe to say that the complexity of this one, especially given the presence of the six visionaries mm-hmm. Dating all the way back to 1981, the original apparitions mm-hmm. and pronouncements, but then we've had these ongoing questions about these ongoing apparitions right. or revelations, that sort of thing. All of that has just added layers of complexity.
Yeah.
And then we can add even further the problems of the dissolution of Yugoslavia, mm-hmm. Conflicts between the Franciscans there and the local diocese. the weighing in of the Yugoslav Bishops' Conference, and then the extended Vatican investigation that was launched under then Joseph Cardinal Ratzinger and then carried forward under Pope Benedict XVI and into the pontificate of Francis. So that's just a small snapshot of the many things that have taken place over the years relating to this, leading ultimately to this declaration.
And if I may throw in two more variables that factor into these works, the life and witness of the seers themselves. The document was very clear about not wanting to take that into account in this in the publication of this report. And also the document actually does acknowledge the inaccuracies and rhetorical issues with some of the messages and makes the declaration with those statements notwithstanding. So this was, I mean, convoluted, I guess, is a proper way to describe how difficult this pronunciation was.
If there's a surprise in this, and it probably shouldn't be now that the declaration is out, is that there were six norms that were established by, or six criteria that were established in these new norms that were promulgated back in May. And it goes basically in descending order of opinion of declaration. But the lowest, of course, is that it is very clear to the dicastery that what they're seeing is not supernatural, and that obviously there is obvious fabrication, erroneous intentions, or with the phrase that they use technically is mythomania, going all the way up to the highest level of approval, which is the nihil obstat, or in the Italian nulla osta. And I think there was some surprise that the nihil obstat was granted to these apparitions. That there were some, logically, I think, who deduced that perhaps it would be maybe the second or even the third category. And I say this because it's important to stress that the nihil obstat was granted to Medjugorje. And that means that this is the highest level of approval that can be granted based on the norms that are here. Now, again, they're not weighing in on the question of the supernaturality.
That's
these,
right.
But they are granting that there are no obstacles, which is the very term itself, nihil obstat.
Nihil obstat, yeah.
On the part of the faithful to have devotion to make these pilgrimages for Medjugorje to be widely known, to be promoted. But again, we have to be clear about what they're saying and what they're not.
Yep. And again, you know, it's couched behind very careful language about prudent observation of the devotion.
That's right. Yeah, and that's one of the points that I think that Cardinal Fernandez, Victor Manuel Fernandez, was making today in his press conference, that the clincher, I think, really is, and there has been discussion about this for some time, the fruits that one can see. And in the declaration today, it talks about that an immediate effect surrounding the phenomena associated with Medjugorje has been the large and growing number of devotees, together with the many people who make pilgrimages there from the most varied places. And it talks about that the positive fruits are most evident in a healthy practice of a life of faith in accordance with the tradition of the Church. So that I think is what's really the key to this, and Cardinal Fernandez mentioned that he had spoken with the Vatican official who has been serving, that's Archbishop Cavalli, to oversee the pastoral care there, and he received just last week, Cardinal Fernandez said, another clean bill of health of everything that they're seeing there. So Pope Francis himself in 2017 expressed, based on the report that was given to him, the so-called Ruini report, based on Cardinal Camillo Ruini, who headed it, who started under Pope Benedict and then carried over into the pontificate of Francis, that there were some concerns about the supposed or alleged ongoing apparitions and messages. But those, at least in the view of the dicastery, are not enough to prevent this nihil obstat. And that, to my mind, is a very significant point.
Right. Just very clear The report speaks about abundant conversions, frequent return to the sacraments. So just based on the arguments of the fruits alone, the spiritual fruits, the Neo-Opsat seems to be resting its merit.
Yes, exactly. Whereas they might potentially have gone with like the second category, preoculis habeatur, where it talks about, although important positive signs are recognized, mm-hmm. There might be confusion or potential risks. No, they made the decision that they would go with the highest level of approval. And I think part of that is trying to put to rest, finally, as far as the Vatican is concerned, some of these controversies that have lingered in the discussions about Medjugorje over the last decades. So I think this is what they're trying to do is to be as definitive as possible mm-hmm. within the obvious theological limitations of the norms themselves mm-hmm. And the call for prudence in discussing these apparitions and how they go about approving them. Now, let's also remember that this comes on the heels of multiple statements from
right.
the dicastery in the recent weeks based on these norms. It's as though they're trying to clear the docket, so to
That's
speak.
That's right. It's been pretty rapid fire.
It has, on other apparitions and other spiritual phenomena around the world. So that leaves just a few out there that have not really been given formal declaration by the dicastery. So it's really as though Cardinal Fernandez, with Pope Francis's full approval, is trying to provide clarity based on these new norms for the faithful around the world who have been asking questions about these apparitions for a very long time.
Well, I'd love to continue this conversation, Matthew, but we're out of time. Thank you so much for making the time to speak with us. This document is copious. We could keep going.
Indeed.
My guest, Dr. Matthew Bunsen, Vice President and Editorial Director of EWTN News, joins us every Thursday to speak about news and church events in light of church teaching, current events. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
Every year, couples who go on the Ave Maria Radio's Good News Cruise testify how their marriages are revitalized and transformed. When we said cabins are filling fast, we meant it. The 2025 cruise is sold out. But it's the Good News Cruise, not the Bad News Cruise. So the 2026 Good News Cruise is planned and taking orders. There'll be new special and surprise guests and familiar ones from Ave Maria Radio, as well as Father Michael Schmitz and Father Joe Krupp. Go to AveMariaRadio.net and click on the travel tab to find out more.
Support for this Ave Maria Radio program comes in part by the non-for-profit St. Anthony Services. Are you shopping for mortgage products, Catholic investing, Catholic health, real estate, or estate planning? StAnthonyServices.org can help you find a Catholic professional for these needs. They regularly connect faithful citizens with faith-based professionals that share our Christian values. More information at StAnthonyServices.org or 877-LIFE-US1.
Underwritten in part by the following nonprofit.
Are you paying high prices with a traditional health insurance company that pays for things that violate your conscience? There's an alternative available. Solidarity HealthShare is a community of faithful individuals and families that never share into immoral medical services, all while saving you money with prices starting as low as $85 per month for singles and $512 for families. Never fund another abortion with your healthcare dollars. Call 844-313-4999 to learn more.
When your children consider going to college, where are you going to find a place that will prepare them for the future and build on the foundation that you've laid? The answer? Ave Maria University. With an authentically Catholic curriculum, including 35 majors, AMU prepares students to take on the world.
My daughter told me she was published in a scientific journal as an undergrad. I'm so proud of her. The world needs Catholic physicists, and my daughter's going to be one of them.
Learn more at avemaria.edu. That's avemaria.edu.
60 on 10 with Monsignor Charles Pope.
The Eighth Commandment. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. At one level, the reputation a person has is one of their most precious gifts, and to intentionally harm the good reputation of someone is a very grave matter. We can do this often through detraction by disclosing others' faults without a valid reason, or calumny, just outright lying about other people, likewise through rash judgment. This commandment also protects the truth, which is another very, very great good. To lie is to speak something that we know is false with the intention of deceiving others. We ought yet to be dedicated to the truth. It is the truth that sets people free, while errors and lies entrap people in many difficult and often sinful situations. The Lord asks us to give witness to the truth of the gospel. This commandment therefore asks us to stay dedicated to the truth and to other people's reputation. The eighth commandment, you shall not bear false witness against your neighbor.
For more about the Ten Commandments, visit EWTNRC.com.
Dr. Ray Guarendi.
He's not on drugs. Parents will come into my office and describe a litany of trouble about this long. Then they'll say this, I'm giving you the wrong impression. Overall, he's a pretty good kid. How so? Well, he's not on drugs or anything like that. One of the new moral high bars out there, he's not on drugs. You want to raise a child not with the absence of pathology, but with the presence of virtue. She's miserable with me, but she treats everybody else great. Again, not the absence of bad behavior, but the presence of good behavior. He's not on drugs? It's a rationale. May provide some comfort. It's not a path to virtue.
Good afternoon, welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. Stigmatas are one of the strangest phenomena in the Catholic faith. Visionaries and mystics who've experienced the stigmata essentially become living mirrors of Christ's crucifixion. They vividly portray before the world Christ's atoning death. We dive into their history with Paul Kengor. Paul is the author of several books, most recently The Stigmatists, Their Gifts, Their Revelations, Their Warnings. His other books include the famous The Devil and Bella Dodd, The Devil and Karl Marx, and A Pope and a President. Paul, thank you for joining us. How are you doing?
Oh, good, Marcus. Very good. And by the way, I just got to point out here that the book was endorsed by our beloved late friend Al Cresta. And I think the last endorsement that I got for that book before it went to print was from Al. So kind of a special connection here.
So fun fact, Paul, there are three people who are attempting to make that claim. Three books. And so my executive producer, Brian.
And with the case of Al, right? So Al was not only personally prolific, but, with words and writing and on the radio, but he read everything, as you know, and I could always count on Al, maybe not for an endorsement, right, but to at least consider one, right?
Right,
He would read the book, and that's good. Well, we'll have to settle the score here on who got
well,
the
we did.
Al Creston.
We did. Yeah? Brian Chainley, my executive producer, looked through Al's final emails because he sent them out. And we have the tally, and your book is officially the final endorsement Al ever wrote for a book.
Oh, what an honor. Wow. Yeah, now that's neat. God rest his soul. I miss him. He was such a great guy. And you're doing a great job.
Oh, thank you,
as his successor, for sure.
Thank you very much. That means a lot, truly. And I want to open this conversation by asking you, I know of your expertise and the areas that you're passionate speaking about. This seems like a bit of a sidestep from what you usually write about, so which tells me that you had a real interest in exploring this topic. What prompted it?
Yeah, well, you know, Marcus, I've always been fascinated by stigmata. When I was a Protestant, an evangelical, Presbyterian, and I mean, you know, we have, you know, eyes to see, right? And when I saw pictures and video of people like Padre Pio, who was in my lifetime, I mean, he died in 1968, and I was born in 1966, so yeah, I was just a couple of years old around the time that he died. But you know, there's pictures, there's photos. I mean, we had earlier this week, September 17th, 2024, is the 800th anniversary of Francis receiving the stigmata. And, you know, a lot of people, you know, consider him the first stigmatist. Now, some people think that St. Paul in the Bible might have been the first. We could talk about that. But in the case of St. Francis, people might say, well, you know, that's 800 years ago. I mean, Yeah, we can't count on that. There's no photos, right? There's no video. And never mind that you've got all these eyewitnesses and biographers and people even right. way back then, right? I mean, there's no coincidence that a whole order popped up around this guy. It's been around for 800 years.
Right.
But
that's
but
also a very...
PO, right?
Sorry, I just want to jump in. As a historian, you're going to appreciate that. That's a very poor premise for saying anything, because then we can't right. trust any historical narrative past photography.
Yeah, exactly right. I mean, you can throw out the entirety of the Gospels if, mm-hmm. if that's your criteria, right? And in fact, I go through, so in the book I have seven specific chapters on different stigmatists, and the one on Francis, when you actually read the eyewitness accounts from Thomas of Celano, one of his first biographers, St. Bonaventure, the head of the order at the time, and other brothers who were there and witnessed everything. I mean, they're very authoritative. They're very convincing.
Right.
I mean, you walk away having really no question that the guy had stigmata, suffered from it, and didn't live a long time after that. I mean, it was really, he had already gone through a period of like severe mortification, probably too severe, probably too much penance yeah. in his case. But then guys like Padre Pio, who's contemporary, we have photos and video. He had stigmata for 50 years.
Yep.
Only going away really kind of in the final days of his life when the Lord took them away.
Yep, just before he passed.
And that, by the way, too, Marcus, that became convincing to a lot of the critics, because suddenly they saw these wounds that had been in his hands for half a century, just suddenly in his hands and his feet and his side just vanishing.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no marking there.
Yep.
Right? I mean, had the guy been pouring acid on the palms of his hands for 50 years, which by the way is just an absurd claim
yep.
by anybody. It's not just going to kind of slowly disappear and vanish like that in the last few days of his life.
And not only that, it would leave tremendous scar tissue if it was acid or if he was self-mutilating, but it was none of that. Mm-hmm. It disappeared and completely healed.
That's right. And he was really, a number of people have told me, you know, the hardest chapter in the book to read is about Padre Pio because of how awful some of the doubters inside the church were.
Yeah.
And Pio even said, what torments me the most, what hurts me the most, even more than the physical pain, are the people in my own church who don't believe me.
Yeah.
And even after he had Vatican officials and cardinals and medical scientists and others who came to him and affirmed that, these are truly the stigmata, but he still had these doubters, and he was a victim of kind of crackpot psychology of the day, where one of the claims was that Pio was doing this via auto-suggestion.
That's right.
I think that's my favorite, right? It's kind of like a step below snake handling, right? auto-suggestion. And Pio had a great sense of humor, kind of cracked up at that one, and he said, tell that psychiatrist to imagine that imagine that he's a bull.
Bull, that's right.
Let's see if horns sprout out of his head. You think I could auto suggest this? Huh? What? Come on. So he was really tormented by the people who didn't believe him, and of course, even once he died, it would be a few decades before it was made official that he was canonized as a saint in the Roman Catholic Church.
Yep, and a true wonder worker of the generation too. I'd like to backtrack into the larger question of stigmata, right? One of the common arguments against the validity of stigmata is that the wounds inflict the hands, but we know from history that Christ was most probably crucified through his wrists. And we have theological answers for this, and you cover this in your book as well.
Yeah, that's right. And in fact, a good friend of mine, Rob Orlando, who I've done a couple films with, and Rob has the new film out, Face to Face with the Shroud, mm-hmm. the Shroud of Turin. And Rob told me, he said, hey, you look at the shroud, it looks like he's bleeding from the wrists, right? Now, of course, the blood would have run down from the palms mm-hmm. to the wrists and to the arms as well, so you could still have the blood stains in either spot.
Right.
But if you actually read the New Testament account, I mean, remember the doubting Thomas, right? The Apostle Thomas, and he says, "Unless I see the marks in his hands, unless I touch them, unless I put my fingers in the palms of his hands." And then Jesus opens, he puts his hands out and says, feel my hands. He doesn't say, look at my wrists. Here, put your finger through my bony wrists, right? I mean, mm-hmm. I know some people think today that Christ was crucified that way. Now, some others have said that, in fact, Father Robert Spitzer has said this, that he thinks it could well be that the nails went in through the front of the palms and then came out through the back of the wrist.
Mm.
So that could be, but on the other hand, most of the stigmatists who have the markings in their hands, like Pio, like Francis,
mm-hmm.
it bled in the front of the palms and in the back,
yep.
and actually there were actual holes
yep.
all the way through Pio's palms, and Francis actually had nail markings.
That's right.
Protruding.
That's right.
Out of his stigma.
Yeah, and they were through and through holes too. We are continuing this conversation with our friend Paul Kengo, author of several books. The one we're talking about today is The Stigmatists, their gifts, their revelations, their warnings. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
When your children consider going to college, where are you going to find a place that will prepare them for the future and build on the foundation that you've laid? The answer? Ave Maria University. With an authentically Catholic curriculum, including 35 majors, AMU prepares students to take on the world.
I've seen the difference in my son since he's been at Ave Maria. He's happy, he's excited about what he's going to do with his degree, and he's living his faith.
Learn more at avemaria.edu. That's avemaria.edu.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you're automatically owned shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria Mutual Funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria Mutual Funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria Mutual Funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
CMF Curo is a Catholic healthcare ministry providing families nationwide with a better solution centered around whole health, spirit, mind, and body. Our members share their medical burdens within a faith-filled community. At CMF Curo, our members have access to a spiritual director, concierge services, and other health and spiritual resources. Find out if CMF Curo is a better solution for your family. Visit MyCatholicHealthcare.com. That's MyCatholicHealthcare.com.
Ave Maria School of Law is the Roman Catholic law school in the United States. Consistently ranked in the Princeton Review as one of the best and most conservative law schools, as well as pre-law's most devout law school. Ave Maria School of Law provides a traditional legal education while emphasizing how the law intersects with the Catholic intellectual tradition and natural law philosophy. Ave Maria School of Law, unabashedly Catholic, consistently excellent. For more information, visit avemarialaw.edu.
Why is the church always considered holy? The church is held to be holy because Jesus Christ, who alone with the Father and the Holy Spirit, is holy. He loved the church as his bride. The Catholic Catechism tells us he gave himself up for her so as to sanctify her and endow her with the gift of the Holy Spirit for God's glory. United with Christ, the church is sanctified by Christ. With him and through him, she becomes sanctifying. All the activities of the church are directed toward the sanctification of persons in Christ and the glorification of God. It is in the church that, by the grace of God, we acquire holiness. The church on earth already is endowed with real, though imperfect, sanctity. In her members, perfect holiness is yet to be acquired, though all members are called to perfect holiness. Charity is considered the soul of holiness. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
It's time for Family Man with Dr. Gregory Popcha.
Do you celebrate the liturgy of domestic church life? It's an approach to family spirituality that can help every Catholic family encounter Christ more meaningfully at home and experience their faith as the source of the warmth in their homes. The Liturgy of Domestic Church Life has three parts: the rite of Christian relationship helps families love each other with Christ's sacrificial love. The rite of family rituals helps families develop Christian attitudes toward work, play, relationships, and faith. And the rite of reaching out helps families learn to serve each other and the world just like Christ. When you live out the Liturgy of Domestic Church Life, you bring the grace of the Eucharist home and let Christ transform everything about the way you live and love each other. To discover more ways your family can celebrate the Liturgy of Domestic Church Life, check out the newest editions of Parenting with Grace and visit CatholicCounselors.com. I'm Dr. Greg Popchak, but you can call me Family Man.
To discover more ways faith can enrich your life, visit CatholicCounselors.com.
Good afternoon. Welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. My guest is Paul Kengor, author of several books, most recently The Stigmatists, Their Gifts, Their Revelations, Their Warnings. Paul, so you've had a tremendous interest in stigmatists. I spent the break kind of thinking about that and marveling at that reality, and I realized that for a lot of us, despite our key interests, there are certain things that grip our fancy. And for you, it's the stigmatists. I think for me, it would be, eagles in general, I guess, but largely Eucharistic miracles. And I'm glad that you had an interest in this because you presented this very systematically. Now, there were some common traits and common sufferings that all of the stigmatists underwent, and this is crucial for us to frame this conversation. So just briefly run through all of them.
Yeah, well, one of them, there seemed to be this like trial period where, as if the Lord was testing these different individuals to see if they'd be capable of this kind of self-sacrifice. So a lot of them were already going through kind of periods of mortification, if you will. I mean, that would especially be somebody like Francis of Assisi. Another one would be Catherine of Siena. They just seem willing to sacrifice.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, a number of them, boy, Catherine of Siena, Anne Catherine Emmerich, Therese Newman. Anne Catherine Emmerich is a blessed. Therese Newman, her cause for canonization has been opened up. They went through what's been called like spiritual anedia. Now they don't all have this, but where they couldn't eat anything but the Eucharist.
Yep.
And we have some cases of some of these stigmatists who for decades. This is usually among the women. But by the way, about 90% of stigmatists are women, which is an interesting thing in and of itself, because you consider the most famous, right, are usually the men, St. Francis, Padre Pio. St. Paul might have been the first, because he says in Galatians, I bear the marks of Christ on my body, and that phrase stigmata actually comes from the Greek in that passage.
Yeah, marks, yeah.
But the idea that some of them, for example, they couldn't eat anything else, Marcus. They would vomit up.
Yeah.
Regular food.
Yeah, Blessed
and
Alexandrina da Costa.
The only thing they could hold down was the Eucharist.
Yep.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah, no, I know of these stories, and I've often marveled at it, because it's a very clear medical testimony, too, that something supernatural is, in fact, happening. There's
right.
No other logical reason for it otherwise.
Yeah. And also, too, there were different types of stigmata that people would have, but typically in the palms of the hands, by the way, never in the wrists, which is another reason why I think some of the claims today that Jesus was crucified through the wrists, which goes against, what we have on our corpuses, our crosses, and artwork, what's said. You know, some people say, well, in the Bible, when they talk about hands, they're talking about they're including wrists. I don't know. I mean, to me, look, these people are genuinely bleeding from their hands, and it's being certified by church officials. I think we should take that as a sign that Christ was probably crucified through the hands, through the palms of his hands.
Mm-hmm.
And at the least, if he's going to give them stigmata, I mean, somebody like Francis around the year 1200 is going to assume that Christ was crucified through the palm of his hand.
Right.
And I don't know how you could give somebody holes in the wrist without them really bleeding so substantially that they would bleed out, right? That they would, I mean, that alone might kill them if they were bleeding through holes in their wrists. But another wound that many of them had, and I find this very interesting theologically, they had the shoulder wound of Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And Anne Catherine Emmerich and Therese Newman, who are two of the greatest visionaries in the history of the church, they claim to be able to have visits from Jesus, see the life of Jesus, see the life of the Blessed Mother, see the lives of different saints. And they said that Jesus told them that his most vexing wound was the shoulder wound.
Mm-hmm. That seems to be a consistent.
The most pain.
That seems to be a consistent testimony for those who had visions of Christ and who bore that shoulder wound, that it was the most vexing wound for them.
Yeah, and if you consider that Christ tells us, if you want to follow me, right, pick up your cross, mm-hmm. carry the cross, and follow me. So, the cross that he puts on his shoulder, that he carries to Calvary. So in a way, and I say this to my evangelical friends, right, especially a lot of the people from the sort of health and wealth gospel who don't understand, why do bad things happen to good people, right? Well, what would Jesus do, they ask, WWJD, what would Jesus do? Well, Jesus would suffer. He would carry the cross. He would put it on his shoulder and carry it, and then he would turn to us and say, if you want to follow me, don't wait for that early retirement. Don't go out and have a good time, drinking and living a life of luxury. If you want to follow me, suffer, sacrifice, pick up the cross, put it on your shoulder, and follow me. So the fact that they would have this shoulder wound, which most people don't see, and was usually a bruise, and something that the stigmatist is kind of like internally feeling, but not manifesting in the way that he or she would with blood coming out of his palms.
Yeah.
I find that theologically kind of profound.
Yep, and very fitting too, that that Christ's greatest, most vexing suffering with regard to the wounds would be the one wherein he bore the cross, and it's right. Invisible. It's not meant to be conspicuous. It's obscure.
Yeah. And I should add, in terms of visible, invisible, there have been some cases of saints who've had invisible stigmata,
mm-hmm.
which I know will immediately invite detractors, right? If I can't see it, there's no way it's happening. but two of the most famous, and no one listening on this show will scoff at this, were Catherine of Siena
mm-hmm.
and Faustina Kowalska, mm-hmm. who both died at the age of 33,
mm-hmm.
like Jesus. In fact, a number of the women who were stigmatists died at the age of 33.
Mm-hmm.
And if you read the diaries, the dialogue of Catherine of Siena, the biographies of her, what was written by her spiritual advisor, if you read the diary of St. Faustina, the first canonized saint of the new millennium, they're not fakers.
Yep, they absolutely are not.
And in fact, Faustina often talks about the other nuns in the convent who are scoffing at her and mocking her and making fun of her. Boy, she's pretending she's sick again. She just wants to get out of washing dishes, right?
Mm-hmm.
So to further humble someone like her, not that she really needed humbling, but to further her sacrifice, Jesus even gives her invisible stigmata that none of the nuns can see, that she alone suffers from. So these are really these intense, pious, suffering souls who are called to this very unique mission, this charism. I think we think probably only 400 or 500 people in the history of humanity that we know of have had the stigmata.
Yeah.
Some of us are called to evangelize, preach the gospel, maybe witness to Christ through your music or your painting or your art or your teaching or your writing or whatever. These people, their call, their charism was to suffer, truly. And in the case of bleeding from their hands, from their feet, wherever, just like Jesus did.
And one thing that also unified quite a lot of them, maybe not all of them, is mystical visions that they had. But we don't have a lot of time to dive into that. What I'd like to pivot to is how you cover the fact that we've had recent stigmata recipients, stigmatists as well. And a lot of these are medically verified in one way or another, some of them not even within the Catholic framework. And like I said, you cover that in a chapter in your book.
Yeah, that's right. In fact, one of the very recent stigmatists who just died, and hardly anyone knows she was a stigmatist, was Sister Agnes, mm-hmm. the Our Lady of Akita seer in Japan, who just died. And Bishop Ito, in his formal letter affirming the supernatural origin of the 1973 Akita visions, said there she had the stigmata. Now, we don't know if she had them because they really kept her under wraps for a long time. I don't think she had them toward the end of her life, but she had them during that period when she was having these visions. And one of her visions, October 13th, 1973, anniversary of the miracle of the sun at Fatima, by the way. Mm-hmm. In fact, Bishop said the message of Akita and Fatima are one and the same.
Right, right.
That's the prophecy that she had about a day would come when bishops would be fighting bishops, clergy against clergy, cardinals against cardinals. And she warned about a great chastisement. So did several of these. St. Faustina, Sister Elena Aiello, who died in the early 1960s.
Yep.
Faustina, Jesus told Faustina, "You will prepare the world for my second coming." So what really struck me about a number of these modern 20th century stigmatists is they had visions of the final days. Really, truly seem to speak to where we are today.
And the visions of the final days, in fact, Blessed Anne Catherine Emmerich also received visions of the life of Mary and the life of Jesus. So they had contributions to the church in terms of teaching, and Catherine of Siena's visions even spoke about corruption that might befall the church in the future. And we're seeing some of that manifest in modernity. So there's a lot that we can gain from appreciating the heritage of the stigmatists.
Yeah, that's right. And Anne Catherine Emmerich had this astonishing vision about the devil being unchained from hell, quote, 50 to 60 years before the year 2000.
Mm.
Now, she's saying this around the year 1800. I think she died in 1824.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually quote the New Testament verses about the devil being chained in hell. But she gave numbers. She said 50 to 60 years before the year 2000, the devil would be unchained. You know, that's the period of the start of World War II,
yep.
Cold War, communism killing all the people, yep. Abortion.
Sexual revolution.
So,
yeah. Paul,
yeah,
I want to say thank you. We're out of time today. My guest has been Paul Kengor, who's the author of The Stigmatists, Their Gifts, Their Revelations, and Their Warnings. Rounding off this hour, let us appreciate the profound mystical heritage that we have in the church. Considering anything from apparitions to private devotions, the most important thing is the objectivity of the deposit of faith. Until next time, I'm Marcus Peter.